Welcome back to Match Volume. We're your hosts, Emma Dessau and Naib Alvarenga.
Naib, I miss you. What are you doing in quarantine? What have you been up to?
I know, it's such a weird time. Honestly, I'm pretty sure I'm on the same page as everyone else, and I've just been spending my time binge-watching my favorite Netflix shows.
Oh, I feel that. I have been doing the same and sometimes, honestly, napping through class a little bit, but we are chugging along in this weird time. So tell us a little bit about who we have on the podcast this week.
Yeah, so this week is going to be awesome. One of our Match Volume team members, Sarah Brenneman, interviews USC Professor Wortman, who specializes in social entrepreneurship, and Professor Harrington, who specializes in business ethics and crisis management. These two are highly intelligent and provide really interesting points about what corporate responsibility is, CSR, why it matters, and what it can look like in the 21st century.
What I find most special about this interview is that both Professor Harrington and Professor Wortman share different perspectives on CSR, and they really engage in a fascinating dialogue and discussion on the topic.
We hope that you enjoy this interview as much as we did, and that it expands your understanding of CSR, and maybe even gives you a model of healthy dialogue on important issues.
So enjoy. Let's jump in.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. So who you are and what you do.
My name is Adley Wortman. I'm the David C. Bennett Professor of Social Entrepreneurship at the Marshall School of Business, where I'm also the founding director of the Brittingham Social Enterprise Lab.
And I'm Catherine Harrington, and I'm a professor at Marshall. I teach courses in business ethics and in crisis management and in leadership.
Well, we're very excited to have both of you here today. The first question I have for you guys is if you can give me your definition of what corporate social responsibility is.
In my world, corporate social responsibility is how businesses engage in positive action towards addressing social, environmental, and health-related issues. One part of that is mitigation of their own bad behavior or reducing their own bad behavior, but I'm much more interested in how they're using resources to proactively address issues.
I think about it just a little bit differently, and these are not mutually exclusive, but I really think about corporate social responsibility as being the notion that we can and in fact ought to hold corporations morally responsible for their actions. So whether or not they're engaged in what Adelaide would call good behavior or mitigating their own bad behavior, I think that we have a responsibility as a society to continue to scrutinize what corporations do, and to the extent that we're able to penalize them when they engage in bad behavior, and to the extent possible, encourage them when they engage in good behavior.
And I have a little bit of a follow-up to that. You both started in banking, is that correct?
He was a real banker. He was an investment banker.
Do you think that your time in banking had an effect on your thoughts of what corporate social responsibility is?
Oh, without a doubt. I think that we were very clear, at least in the industry that I was in, which is investment banking, that our responsibility began and ended with regulation, meaning that we, in our own opinions at least, believe that, one, we had no responsibility to do anything but exactly what was written in the regulations that stopped us from doing something, and in fact went further to think ahead of it, which means what was it that we could do to make money that the regulators hadn't figured out yet in their existing laws.
And of course, this didn't happen when you were still in investment banking, I don't think, but I think that's how we got CDOs and synthetic swaps, right? Staying ahead of the regulators.
I mean, I was there when it was created and was slightly involved in it. I think that but it wasn't staying ahead of the regulators. It was money being made at the margins, which means what was it that they hadn't thought of yet? How could we create products to take advantage of it? And then we knew somewhat deep down inside that once they caught up with us, they'd make it against the law, and we'd hire smarter and smarter people to try to get ahead of them again.
Just to be clear, if you guys don't feel comfortable with any of the questions, you do not have to answer.
Having fun.
I'm having a blast. You know, Adelaide did real banking. I was just in consumer banking, mortgage lending, and savings, and you know, consumer credit card products, and stuff like that. I think my notion of my thinking around corporate social responsibility comes a lot as a byproduct of the way I was raised. And by the time I was in my middle 30s, I had led a couple of relatively small organizations, but I was really interested just as an observer in understanding what leadership meant. I formed just a hypothesis at that point in time that doing ethics in the real world and leading organizations in the real world are really similar kinds of activities. Which is what caused me to quit a perfectly good paying job and go get a PhD in religion and social ethics. But during my studies, my PhD studies, I was able to put more flesh on that hypothesis. And I have come to believe that leading organizations in the real world is ultimately about pursuing what we value. That's what doing ethics in the real world is about too, pursuing what we value. And so out of that comes my notion that we really ought to hold organizations morally accountable for the way they behave and the consequences of their actions.
Where do you think the line is between corporate social responsibility and where the government needs to step in for a corporation to behave well in our society? Do you think the government has a role in that?
There is an issue regarding when CSR, any this term's a weird term, but this kind of behavior that we want to see corporations do, when does it put them at potentially a competitive disadvantage? So the question is, what's the point at which we say, hey, you're allowed to pollute up to X, but it's just wrong to do that. But when it's wrong to do that, if you don't do it, it's going to cost you money and put you at a competitive disadvantage, which owners of your stock might not be that happy with. So in those cases, when government steps in and says, okay, this is the line that you can't cross, then it allows me to do what I wanted to do potentially in the first place, but without... But it's a level playing field now. Every one of my competitors also can't do this. Therefore, I appreciate government doing it. We saw it recently when the car companies came up with an agreement with the state of California, where all they said is just tell us what the number is and we'll hit that number. We just need certainty to hit the number. Now, you know, our current federal administration stepped in and said that they would not allow companies to make a deal with one state at a time, especially the state of California. But nonetheless, the companies were very quick to say, just tell us what the rules of the game are and we'll play by it. But without knowing the rules, we're having a hard time planning.
Yeah, that's. I think that's a great example and interesting to, I mean, it's a whole nother podcast to think about why it is the federal government stepped in and said, no, you can't make that agreement, whether it was because they didn't want it to be state by state or because they didn't want it to be the state of California.
Right.
But, you know, we have all kinds of institutional actors, right? So you have local and state and federal governments, and they have a certain set of roles and responsibilities. And you have companies that have another set of roles and responsibilities. And it's a kind of an ongoing puzzle to fit those roles and responsibilities together. And there's a natural, I think, back and forth with rule setting or boundary setting and organizations, for-profit organizations, exploring the edges of those boundaries to the extent that they're able to.
Can I jump back?
Yeah, of course.
Isn't it dangerous to roll back when we say things like, I'm misquoting you, so I will tell you in advance I'm misquoting you, but essentially to say that It's where your values align with your behavior, right? Is the sort of ethical way, is that right?
Well, I think all human beings, I don't think any human endeavor is value neutral. And so whether it's implicit or explicit, I think human beings pursue what they value. And I think organizations typically have a kind of ethos and a set of things that are important to them. And all organizations make trade-offs in any particular situation to sub-optimize on one thing they value or another. And so I think we can understand what is important to organizations by looking at the way they behave.
So in the world of a social responsibility, some responsibility that they have, don't we put ourselves at risk that by leaving it just to the corporations internally, that sort of what we see today in the political sphere, where it seems like we have very opposites at some point, sense of what we value, what's good, what's bad, what a corporation's responsibility is versus what it isn't. Do we need to punish bad behavior? From is it the consumer's job? Is it the employee's job? Whose job is it to sort of hold those values to task in terms of matching their own?
Well, I think, first of all, I don't think that, I think of looking at corporate values as being a diagnostic exercise, not a definitional exercise. Mm. One can learn a lot about what is important to organizations by looking at the kinds of decisions that they make. I mean, look at BP Deepwater Horizon, and you see an incredibly sophisticated, large, powerful multinational corporation that continuously sub-optimized on profit at the expense of safety and at the expense of long-term productivity. Gives me a particular point of view about that organization. I don't expect, nor would I ever suggest, that we should just rely on organizations to make the world a better place. I think you and I are in complete agreement on that. I do think that we have other institutional actors, state, local government organizations in particular, to set boundaries in ways that one hopes protects the public good. Of course, we could argue that's not going on in a lot of places right now.
Unfortunately.
So you brought up BP Deepwater Horizon. So my next question, and feel free to discuss this one as well, is if you could give me an example and our listeners an example of a company that you feel has done CSR really well, has exemplified it in a really good way.
Well, one of the cases that we did in our class mm-hmm. earlier in the semester has to do with Merck stumbling over what ultimately ended up being a cure for river blindness, which has no economic market. And so the situation that Merck found themselves in was that they had a drug for horses that might be able to be conformed for human use to prevent river blindness. And there the question that they faced was, do we spend our own money to see if this will work, given that we know we're never going to make any money? There's nobody has any money to buy it. And what Merck did at first was to go around and try and give away the research they had up to that point, and no one would take it. They decided, not because they're altruistic, but because of their very strong scientific culture and the excitement of their scientists at discovering this potential new use, they decided they had to go forward with and try to develop a drug for human use. Once they had a drug for human use, they tried to give that away and nobody would take it. And then I think for altruistic reasons, they spent 20 years at their own expense manufacturing and distributing that drug. Now there are now distribution channels that are established, but Merck still manufactures that drug for free.
I checked their website. It's still up there as one of their like philanthropic
And it's one of the it's one of the greatest, largest, and most impactful examples of a company doing something like that that I think we've ever seen.
I love that story. I love that case. But the key point in that case that I keep coming back to is that one point at which we said, but they realized that for their own employees, they needed to do that. Not for their own sense of well-being, not because they felt it was their duty as a corporation at all. In fact, they knew it was running counter to that. They needed to roll back and find some hook to hang the idea and the decision to make this difference.
Don't you think organizations have multiple values? I mean, to say that it runs counter to their values. I mean, a Merck certainly at that time was balancing multiple values, right? Of producing wealth for the shareholders, for upholding the integrity of their scientific efforts, for on and on and on.
Yeah. You know, my roommate in business school, my apartment mate in business school, who's a great, I would say, drunk Yale poet, he did this great speech when we started business school, impromptu speech, and he did a speech on how all morality codes are arbitrary. we fit them into the situation that we're in. Yes, I think that the people who run corporations have multiple values, that they're competing against each other, and how they make those decisions both includes their own values as well as the restrictions that they're under, the pressures that they're under from inside and outside. I love that story, but I also think a lot about how you pay your people, how you pay your own employees. Like, who do you think about as your stakeholders? The biggest change that we're just seeing now is the question of, are my stakeholders just shareholders, or are employees stakeholders? Is the environment a stakeholder? Are consumers stakeholders? Is the communities that I work in, are they stakeholders? And I think that if we start to expand that notion of who our stakeholders are, then we start looking at CSR a little differently. I always think of the story of Henry Ford, maybe one of the biggest asses in the history of business.
He's keeping it clean, people.
Right. Yeah, thank you. I worked real hard on thinking that one. But nonetheless, he had this great line where he said, I should never pay an employee any less than what they would need to buy one of our own cars. And yet you have Walmart and Amazon, et cetera, even the United States military, who are paying people at a level where they have to be on food stamps in order to live. I think those kind of questions as to who's paying fair wages. So to me, the companies that you start to see that I like are Salesforce. Salesforce, to me, is one of the top players, not because of their, you know, they started a 1% of their equity, 1% of their revenues, and 1% of their company's employees' time, but more so in the sort of way that they have been willing to act in the world along to the values that they see of the company and such. And one of my favorite stories is when Indiana said that they were going to make gay marriage illegal. Mark Benioff is the founder and CEO of the company, and a Trojan, stood up and said, I am moving all of our operations out of Indiana, and we'll pay for any employee to move that wants to move with us. To me,
That's just cool.
That's just cool.
That's just cool.
Right, it is. And it's its own method of CSR that really goes to the core of a business, to me, as opposed to just an action. Think about the message that's sent to everybody, to its own employees, to its communities.
To Indiana.
To
So why are those examples so few and far between? Why is Salesforce so unusual?
I think Mark Benioff still owns a great portion of the company.
Oh, well, that would help.
And that, well, that, I mean, one of the
in terms of his degrees of freedom in making choices.
Exactly. So, I mean, one of them is we see privately owned companies, right? Ones that are closely held. So one of the examples of that is Patagonia. Everybody points to Patagonia. But Yvon Chouinard still owns Patagonia, and he can do whatever he wants with his money, right? So his idea of, I'm going to make you a sweater, a fleece that you buy one time and never have to buy another one, and if it breaks, send it to us.
Which is a good thing, given how much those sweaters cost.
Right, well, right. So, but that's the thing is, right, is he knows that by selling sweaters that expensive, he's going to make his market smaller. He knows that by making it so that in 10 years you can send your sweater back and get a new zipper put on, that he's going to reduce his profits, but it's his money he's playing with. The question then becomes, without absent regulation, whose money am I really playing with? When I do these things, whose risk did I create? So yes, for Benioff, for other companies where it's more closely held, where the owner or the CEO is still a major owner, founder, then we have more room for good acting. When we separate it out and everybody's acting bonus to bonus, and every year the board of directors decides on the CEO's bonus based totally on income of the company, then, you know, the bad actors are incentivized to play.
And companies that are, in certain instances, good actors can also be bad actors, right? I mean, if you look at how Merck dealt with Vioxx when they brought Vioxx to market and affirmatively working to hide the heart attack incidences in the clinical trials data that they were reporting, including changing the time frame of data they reported in an article that was in the New England Journal of Medicine, for crying out loud. And, I mean, they were just affirmatively hiding stuff. Same company, 20 years later, different leadership, different market position, different pressures. So one good act does not a good company make.
Mm. Yeah. Beautifully said.
Because I feel like with our news cycle and how quickly it goes, we do tend to forget some of the failed corporate social responsibility moments. Can you give us an example of a company or event where they have botched CSR, or it is just a failed moment of CSR?
I'll go with what my students know is my single most hated company, which is Tom's Shoes, right? So Tom's Shoes came up with this marketing mode, or I'll give them credit for the fact that he saw a shortage of shoes out there. What he then did is put
for this he's famous,
right? Oh yes, and do the buy one give one, right? Oh. So he created the buy one give one. The problem is that the giving one created a level of unfairness. The giving one put shoemakers and shoe repair people out of business. I actually love a story of a social venture VC that I was with in Santa Barbara at one point in time, who had flown down to Peru to work with a town that was known for its shoemakers as making top quality shoes. And they were about to invest a lot of money in sort of building a factory and making them a more sustainable, larger entity that could get a world brand name. And while they were sitting in the meeting, a Tom's Shoes truck pulled up and dropped off 1,000 pairs of cheap shoes and drove off. And that sort of came back and bit them, because everybody started saying, wow, they say they're doing a good thing, but it actually isn't a good thing. They're taking away jobs. They're taking away opportunities where they shouldn't. And it ended up, you know, actually reducing the company's sales quite significantly. Damn. So what's your example, Professor?
Well, Harrington? You know, I think of CSR differently than you do. And so I just think of, I stop at botched. Right.
Yeah.
And there are plenty of examples of botched. But one of the ones that kind of stands out to me maybe because we did it recently in class, in one of my classes, but is the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster. And when you think about not so much an organization that set itself up as doing good, but an organization, NASA, that was, you know, the Space Shuttle program, which was going to be the shining star of that decade of this great engineering space exploration activity that the United States was famous for. And you think about, at least when I think about, all of the sophisticated, experienced, talented people and organizations that were involved in that. And you think through all that they knew before they made the decision to launch. You have this relatively small group of people, 25 or 30 people, making a launch decision that just absolutely murdered 7 people. They knew they had O-ring problems. They knew what the temperature tolerances were. The temperature tolerances were 53 degrees. They knew it was 23 degrees on the launch pad that night. And they launched. And what I think is very useful about that case is, A, how technically excellent Morton Thiokol, NASA, Kennedy Space Center, Rockwell, et cetera, were. And also, but also, the extent to which they succumbed to external pressures and ended up making a decision that was just horribly flawed. And 7 people died.
Yeah. What do you want students to take away from your classes and working in the social enterprise lab? And what do you want them to take on into the workforce so that maybe we do a better job of using CSR in the future? Or what do you want them to take away?
Well, I always want Trojans to take responsibility for their communities and for the world. One option is to go all in and work at a nonprofit, just throw your life at it, which is not sacrifice. It's phenomenal work and truly important work. Or work for a social enterprise, a company that is built to solve a social problem. But beyond that, our students are going to, minds, time are going to be under quite a high bit of demand, thank goodness. I mean, we're admitting fantastic students. Thank you, Dr. Harrington. We are giving them great educations. I want them to work for the good guys, the good women, the good companies. And we know who they are. We know who the bad ones are. And we know who the good ones are. And I think that it's just, I want to hear that when people are making the decision as to where they're going to work, they're going to think about, is this a company I want to be associated with? Not just, is this a prestigious company or a high-paying company, but one that I want my grandchildren to be proud I work for.
Can I just say I want what he wants?
Sure.
No.
If you want to say that, that's totally fine.
No, I think that's brilliant. You know, about 25 years ago, a historian at the University of Wisconsin-Madison wrote an article about what it would take to be an educated person in the 21st century. And he lists about 10 qualities. But he ends his article by saying, more than anything else, to be an educated person in the 21st century will mean being able to see connections that allow us to make sense of the world and act within it in creative ways. That's what I hope for all of our students, to be able to see connections that allow them to make sense of this world full of all kinds of wicked problems and choose with great intention to act within it in creative ways.
Bravo.
Those are both great answers. So our final question, and I warned you about this beforehand, is what is one question that people should be asking themselves more?
Well, you warned us in advance, but none of us were ready.
Go ahead. Okay, then you go first.
You go first.
For me, and this is something that I work on all the time and sometimes do better than at other times in my life, is intentionality. And when I am thinking about and attending to, am I exactly where I should be right now at this moment in my life and at this moment in the world that I find myself in? I'm in much better shape than if I am not thinking intentionally about that. And it's been very powerful for me. I've seen it be very powerful for others to be, you know, so I guess to answer the question the way you've put it, Sarah, is am I living an intentional life right at, not forever, right at this moment, am I where I'm supposed to be? I think it's a useful question to ask.
A heavy question to ask, too. Yeah, sure. I'm going to spend the rest of my life keep asking that question since I get to do it moment to moment. Thank you. I'm serious. So there's an old saying that I try to live by. The saying was, and you won't even understand this, the saying was, don't do anything that you don't want to read on the front page of the New York Times. And I still live that way. I still think really hard when I make decisions, when words come out of my mouth, whether this is really something that in the light of day, without the convenience of context and all of that, I really want to be out there in the world. And I use that very carefully as a screen for how I act.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming. We really enjoyed having you on the
podcast
today.
This has been a blast.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks.
That was Professor Wertman with Professor Harrington and Sarah Brigman.
That's all for today, everyone. We really hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, make sure to subscribe. We have some cool stuff coming for you next week, and you don't want to miss it.
Match Volume is a production of Annenberg Media through USC's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. This episode was produced by Emma Dessau and Sarah Brengman. I'm Emma Dessau.
I'm Naib Alvarenga. Thanks for listening.